I'm Tom Rowan. You're tuned into Turn on the News, 3.9's daily look at radio art, radio news, media news, sound art, and more. Tonight, the FCC fines broadcasters for not airing a telephone conversation they recorded. Well, not for not airing it, but they fine them for a recording that was never on the radio. Also, the TV networks are suing over people not watching their advertisements. And the United States Senate, there are some folks who want to reinstate domestic propaganda. We've got crazy news tonight. And we'll also look back from Lessons from Weimar Radio with Heather Contat from last weekend's TransX Transmission Arts Symposium in Toronto, Canada. Stay tuned to Turn on the News from free103.9.org. Tom Rowe with Turn on the News. Tonight behind us is Daniel Blinkhorn's Relatively Loud Tones from Terra Symphonica from the Deep Wireless 8 Radio Art Compilation. Deep Wireless is the monthly radio art festival in Toronto, Canada. And it used to, the final weekend of May would be the Radio Without Boundaries Conference. This year it was renamed the TransX Transmission Art Symposium. And Free 103 was there, recording all sorts of events there. And we'll listen to Heather Contat's Lessons from Weimar Radio in a few minutes after that. Radio headlines first. And we go to Kim Andrew Elliott's reporting on international broadcasting blog at kimelly.nfshost.com. He rounds up coverage of the effort to repeal the Smith-Mundt Act of 1948 in the U.S., which disallowed domestic propaganda after World War II. There are a couple of senators, representatives and senators. This is in the House, actually, so it's not senators. In the House, representatives. And there's a statement from Communications Director for Senator Kirsten Gillibrand in BuzzFeed. She's a New York senator who's on the Senate Armed Forces Committee, where the bill is being considered. She says that as of last Thursday afternoon, the current does not include an amendment to, quote, strike the current ban on domestic dissemination. At the Columbia Journalism Review, let's round up. I'll get to that in a moment. Radio World also reports, Paul McLean writes there, as Radio World has reported the there are a couple senators supporting repeal of the 1948 ban on, quote, domestic dissemination, unquote, of content to listeners and viewers in the United States. The board believes the rule did not envision the internet or satellite broadcasting, which does not honor national boundaries. With all of its 59 languages available online, the agency cannot comply with this outdated statute. Right Side News, a right-wing, more right-oriented publication, says, quote, if the government propaganda experts decide that they don't like you, it is quite likely they could end up being a target of a massive misinformation campaign. It could come down to the fact that they simply don't like your blog or what you're saying on Facebook. They could decide it is best to destroy your reputation for the sake of, quote, national security. The Columbia Journalism Review, Emily T. Metzger weighs in. We, quote, we can't, as of now, really know whether the content of Voice of America is in fact truthful or propagandistic, routinely biased for or against the United States, whether the content champions are condemns American foreign policy. This content broadcast to audiences around the world can be exempted from American Freedom of Information requests, and American ethnic media outlets are prevented from rebroadcasting news that would serve their communities. With the ban, all we know for certain is that the content is financed by the U.S. government. This doesn't necessarily make it propaganda, but it certainly does make the content worthy of the same scrutiny savvy audiences apply to all media, unquote. Uh, Over at HollywoodReporter.com, Matthew Bellany reports on that Fox, CBS, NBC are suing the Dish Network over AutoHop, an ad skipper product, and Dish has filed a countersuit against them because they don't want consumers to be able to skip advertisements. And the Fox statement, "We were given no choice but to file suit against one of our largest distributors, Dish Network, because of their surprising move to market a product with the clear goal of violating copyrights." Copyrights. It violates copyrights to not listen to or watch something, and destroying the fundamental underpinnings of the broadcast television ecosystem. Their wrong-headed decision requires us to take swift action in order to aggressively defend the future of free over-the-air television. David Oxenford reports at his broadcast law blog that, with the headline, $2,000 fine for recording telephone conversation even though the conversation was never broadcast. The FCC last week proposed to fine a broadcaster for calling someone with their tape recorder running with the intent to broadcast the taped conversation on the air. According to the notice of apparent liability issued by the FCC, the recording was stopped after the radio station announcers identified who they were and the person who was called said that he did not want to be recorded. What was taped was essentially the station employees calling the individual and saying hello, saying that they were from the radio station, telling the individual that he was being recorded, and the individual telling the employees to stop recording, which they immediately did. The recording was ended before anything substantive was said, and it was never broadcast on the air. Nevertheless, the station was fined $2,000 because the initial stages of the conversation were recorded with the intent to use the recording on the air. According to the commission, the FCC's rules require that when a conversation is either broadcast on the air or recorded for purposes of broadcast, the consent of the person being recorded must be obtained before the tape starts rolling. As with an over-the-air broadcast, if the tape is running when the person is being called by the station says hello, in the commission's view, the station has violated the rule even if the tape is never used. And, of course, no one is using tape anymore. But when you press record on something like Audacity, and if you're the only one in the studio because you're a community radio station, it's often much, much easier to press record before you start messing with some other equipment that busies your hand so that you can no longer press the button to record. So this might be a budget issue, actually, that forcing small radio stations to have more than one engineer at a time. That was from David Oxenford's broadcast law blog. And now we're going to go to Toronto last weekend, where Heather Content gave us talk about lessons from Weimar Radio. The Weimar Republic occurred in Germany between 1919 and 1933. It was Germany's first democracy, known for its cultural developments and political volatility. A new series of revolutions in November 1918 and the abdication of imperial ruler Kaiser Wilhelm II led to its founding. The appointment of Adolf Hitler as German chancellor marked its ending. In addition to being the first German democracy, the Weimar Republic was also the first epoch to use radio as a public mass medium. So here is Heather Content, and we should introduce her first. She studies and produces radio. She does the podcast for N Plus One magazine and has taught at Pratt and the New School. She's currently seeking a PhD in programs where she can study the phenomenology of sound. And here is her talk from Toronto, Canada, from the TransX Transmission Art Symposium, Memorial Day weekend.
And hello, radio listeners that I cannot see. I'm very excited to address you. So I have some visuals, though. Use your imagination. Good luck. Okay. So when I started this project, I had no idea how pertinent it would be to the topics that we've discussed. So with that being said, the Weimar Republic is the period in Germany between 1919 and 1933. It was Germany's first democracy. It was known for its cultural development and political volatility. It was also the first period to use radio as a public medium. We'll just turn that down. Okay. So there were a lot of lessons that you can learn from studying Weimar radio. And here they are. Number one, there will always be boundaries. Number two, when you work in tension with these boundaries, you might create an aesthetic to shift the boundaries. Three, even though the boundaries are shifted, they are still boundaries. So, in the case of the Weimar Republic, there were two different types of boundaries. There were political boundaries and technical boundaries. The government of the Weimar Republic was particularly concerned that some extreme factions might use the radio as a way to incite a revolution. Perhaps the reason why they thought this is because on November 9th, 1918, that's the same day that Philipp Scheidemann stood on the Reichstag and declared democracy, 20 miles south of Berlin, there was also a radio revolution happening when a bunch of decommissioned military personnel who had all been trained to operate radios in the trenches, they took over the military-controlled radio station and made it a public radio station for the first time. This was called the Funkerspuk, or Radio Nightmare. So politicians were, they were a little concerned. And so they put this guy, Hans Bredow. He's in this stamp right here. Oops. Go back, go back. He's in the stamp right here. They put him in charge of the Reichsrundfunk Gesellschaft, which is basically the National German Radio Society. And he believed, he set some mandates. None of this was a legal thing that was discussed in the parliament or anything. It was all just a series of bureaucratic mandates that later became institutionalized in 1926 when they were just like, hey, by the way, these are the laws that we've made up. So of these things that Bredow had a major part in establishing, one, radio should placate the public, calm them from their troubles and their worries. Two, we should educate the public about high German culture. Three, non-political. Let's just not talk about politics at all. So, those were the general guidelines that established the political arm of Weimar Radio. There were also technical limitations, too. And this just comes from the fact that radio was in its infancy. The technology was in its infancy. From this picture, you can see some people listening to an early radio. They are all attached umbilically with headphones. That's because that was the only way to listen. External speakers didn't come till much later. It's funny that they're all wearing headphones because all these broadcasts are in mono. This cable coming down from the lamp is attached to the generator outside to power this machine, which uses vacuum tubes, making it able to receive air frequency radio waves. Most of Weimar Republic radio listening happened using just the ground waves, which do not travel very far. So actually the amount, the area of people able to listen to radio during the Weimar Republic was very small, and it was mostly an urban phenomenon. If you wanted to have a better set, you could listen to the airwaves and listen farther out, but that was expensive. So one interesting thing that happened during this time is this is when radio, 1923, when they actually established radio as a public medium, this is when they transformed radio from a two-way communications apparatus to a one-way broadcast-only directional system. Prior to that, it had always been two-way. During World War I, always two-way. The reason why they did this, they were afraid of all those people that knew how to hack receivers and turn them into transmitters. So they made it illegal to adjust your receiver, which you needed a license in order to own. This, ultimately, the technical and the political, led to an institution of Weimar Radio that was boring. It broadcasted in just one direction, and as Urchin says, it broadcast culture with a capital C. worked at the Frankfurt radio station, which hired Walter Benjamin to produce some children's shows. These were called Aufklärung für Kinder. There should be some umlauts in there, but Prezi doesn't like umlauts. So, he told radio stories. And they were pretty basic radio stories. They sounded much like anything else that you would hear on the air. They sounded like... This is called Zigeunerlied or Gypsy Song. Now, I take some liberties here with syllables. And if you know your avant-garde history, this is kind of like the Dadaist and Surrealist poetry, which is not culture with a capital C. It is culture with a lowercase c. You know, people's culture. Kind of like jazz. So what he did is he worked in tension with this institutionalized system. He was on the inside, though, right? He was totally allowed to do this. And by working in tension, he sort of shifted the institution. Here he is, pushing against those institutional walls. And I call these radio epiphanies. And the reason why is because they don't create harmony, they don't create dissonance, nor symphony or cacophony. Instead, they are epic. They are epic forms of radio or epic phony. For those listening to them, they might get an epiphany about the institution that they live in, the fact that it can be changed, that there are alternatives, and that's important. So, there were other epiphanies, too. They happened in two distinct ways, subversively or blatantly. So there were people on the inside, like Benjamin, pushing on the walls. This includes Hans Flesch, who Galen talked about yesterday, thank you, so if Hans Bredow was the man of Weimar radio, Hans Flesch was the dude. And he was a kind of created the idea of program director. And he did, in 1924, a play called Zauberei auf dem Sender, which is Sorcery of the Airwaves. What it is, you know, everybody expected to tune in and hear a symphony for the night. But instead, they got a disaster. This is just the station calling out. Okay, and there's the interruption. So what happens is basically the storyteller comes in and she wants to tell a story. And it just proceeds like this. The transmitter goes out. It's a total disaster. Well, this was 1924, 15 years before Orson Welles did his thing, when people were also planning to hear a symphony and got something else instead. So Flesch also commissioned, a few years later, Walter Ruttmann's Weekend, which I'm sure everyone knows. Maybe not. It's a sound collage that was constructed using sound film, a new technology. The whole time that this is happening, Flesch maintains that he wasn't trying to be political or do art. He was just testing out the technologies, okay? He was just, you know, trying to further the radio medium. This was not meant to disrupt, but it did. I mean, this is totally different. And although it's about 25 years early, it's like what Pierre Schaeffer did when he made sound art for the first time. So they say. people could produce epiphanies was by working outside of the radio institution. And for this, there were workers' radio collectives, and they did really cool things like we do, which is have conferences and listen to things in order to discuss how the world works, how radio works, how these institutions work. They built little tiny transmitters, stuff like that. They even also once kidnapped this guy that was supposed to appear on the radio and sent in their own guy instead, who went on the air and started talking about... who went on the air and started talking about anti-war stuff. So that's just a really funny story. And then there was also everybody's favorite, Bertolt Brecht, who did the Lehrstück. And this is what he talks about in Radio is Two-Way Communication Apparatus, that big essay that we all know. And basically it was the idea was, this was a radio piece that you would communicate with. You would have lines and you would perform them with the radio. So here's some of this recently online. And if you listen to it long enough, you will hear it, and it doesn't sound so radical. In fact, it sounds like Brecht. You know, this is not too radical sounding to me. But there's a reason why. That's because after these boundaries were shifted, they still were boundaries. And Brecht was particularly affected by what Adorno calls the culture industry. And what that is basically the idea that culture becomes a commodity and people make money off of it. And this happened big time in Three Penny Opera, which is when they made Three Penny Opera merchandise like socks. Now, if you are a Benjamin fan, then you will know the alternative of the culture industry is the politicization of aesthetic. And that's when the culture industry becomes when culture becomes used as a device by a political power in order to propagate their own message. As Benjamin states it, they give people aesthetics so that they can express themselves, express themselves freely, but they don't give them any of the rights that might go with that aesthetic or might have developed that aesthetic in the first place. That, for him, is fascism and only has one effect, which is war. So, to exemplify this, we have Walter Ruttmann, who ended up working as assistant director for Leni Riefenstahl in Triumph of the Will in order to survive and keep practicing his art. He didn't get to express his own message, which was pretty leftist. Instead, he expressed propaganda of National Socialism. And also in Triumph of the Will, there's a scene in it where we see the Reichsarbeitsdienst perform what seems to be a Lehrstück, a call and response thing. Susan Sontag discusses that what happens here is the self-awareness of Brecht's Lehrstück, of the medium, the self-awareness of the medium gets taken away just in its pure portrayal. So that's what happens. It's a big cycle. There are boundaries, there are epiphanies to shift those boundaries, but they are still boundaries. And it goes over and over and over. And you should be prepared for that, because that's how it works. And for this, I like to look at Badiou, Alain Badiou, who basically says in Theory of the Subject, although I have no idea what that book's really about, I don't think anyone does, but what I gather from it is that you just have to keep trying. And you have to be prepared to push a boundary and have it become solid. And then push it again, or have other people push things too. So, that's it.
Thank you, Heather. That was wonderful. This is the time for question segment, and as always, if you can direct your questions to the microphone down on the floor.
Hi, could you tell us how pushing boundaries in your own work has worked, has worked or not worked? Give us any examples.
Well, I could talk about institutional boundaries. So I come from an institution that has some audio training, but not very much. It also has some audio equipment that usually doesn't work. Anyway, it's taught me to become a pretty rad producer with good problem-solving skills. Aesthetically is a little harder. For this, I like to sort of take something I've learned from, I want to say it's Jay Allison, who talks about, you know, sometimes you have to do work because it's paid, and it's not what you want to do. But you just have to do little things that are just little pieces of yourself, and putting little pieces of yourself in there. So, yeah. Also, I always try to do things as self-reflexively as I can. I don't know why that how that is a boundary. I guess some of the radio that I produce is for an institution that does not seem to look at itself very much, so I like to make it look at itself.
I'm Tom Burr. You're listening to Turn on the News. That was Heather Content from Brooklyn talking about lessons from Weimar Radio from the TransX Transmission Art Symposium in Toronto, Canada in the last week of May, broadcast on Free 103.9. You can hear the full recording with the full question and answer session at free103.9.org, where you can also find out more about transmission art and radio art, and you can also see newsroom.free103.9.org for more information. I'm Tom Rowe. You're listening to a special edition of Turn on the News, 3103.9's daily look at radio art, radio news, media news, sound art, and more. We're looking at the TransX Transmission Art Symposium, May 25th through 27th in Toronto, Canada, hosted by New Adventures in Sound Art. And today we're going to listen to David Cecchetto's keynote address, one of the keynote addresses at the TransX Transmission Art Symposium. This was on Sunday, May 27th. And it's titled Sound as Transmission, Towards and Away from the Non-Cochlear Ear. New Adventures in Sound Art, Darren Copeland introduces David Cecchetto.
We are pleased to present David Cecchetto, here, based here in Toronto now. And his keynote address, Sound as Transmission, Towards and Away from Non-Cochlear Sound Art. And in his note, he says, the expanded understanding of sound that resists the implicit claims to authenticity of both Schaeffer's sound itself and Cage's attentional injunction nonetheless includes both, and it is precisely through the ambivalence that we can fully embrace sound's potential to reconfigure or refigure contemporary forms of communication, and particularly networks. And discussed will be two projects, SRMP and Exurbia.
I'm going to start with two things that I'm not going to explain, in addition to the sound that I'm not really going to talk about, but two things that I'm not going to explain, but have served for me as kind of Zen cones for this topic that I want to talk about today, which is really the question of the medial specificity of sound. So what is actually specific to sound as a medium? So the Zen cone, right, is contemplating the sound of one hand clapping. So these are two things that, for me, have served as that sort of function. And one is this equation that you can see on the screen for the people on the radio. It's x over y equals x over z. So you could probably see how this would solve, right? I'm not a mathematician, so tell me if I'm wrong, but I presume it could solve one of two ways, or two of two ways, and one is to have x equals zero, right, which is, of course, a kind of total abstraction, or the other is to have y equal z, which was just to say that x over y equals x over y. And to me, again, I'm not going to explain why this is beguiling to me, but it's something that that I spend a lot of time thinking about, because you know, numbers are always abstract, sound is always abstract, and I think there's some correlations between the history of numbers and the history of sound. And you know, the ancient Greeks had no number zero, right? So it's like a total abstraction, something to contemplate. The other maybe less serious cone is something that's been with me for about 12 years, and if you're one of the like 12 people in the world who have heard my music from 12 years ago, you'll know that I actually used to feature it in a number of pieces when I was still a composer, a cultural theorist primarily now. And that's a joke, and it goes like this. Jokes don't have to be funny, by the way. I think this one's funny, but it might not be. So these two farmers are watching the installation of the first telephone lines in their region, and the one farmer turns to the others and he says, you know, I just don't understand these contemporary technologies. They're so complicated. And the second farmer says, well, you know, they're not. You just have to know how to think about them. So take the telephone, for example, right? It's just like a really long wiener dog. And you grab its tail at your house and it barks somewhere in the middle of the city, right? And the guy thinks about it. He says, okay, yeah, that's, I get that. But then how do you explain radio? He says, well, radio is exactly the same, but without the dog. So as I said, I don't have time to go into why these are beguiling to me, but I think they both point to the ways, exactly what we're thinking about when we think about this. What I recognize is a somewhat academic, but I hope also artistic question of medial specificity. So what I'm going to try to do today is just offer some thoughts on the medial specificity of sound, right, which is to say, on a set of metaphors, materials, and discourses that we imply when we're talking about sound, right? And when we're talking, we're always talking in metaphors, materials, and discourses. So I'm going to address the question of transmission obliquely rather than directly. What I hope is that maybe I can help to catalyze some emerging connections that I think are there between transmission art and the discourses of sound art, new media, and contemporary critical theory, which is my sort of lingua franca. So maybe I can contribute to this kind of collective storm that's happening at the symposium that's really been making my head spin in the best way. I think there is a connection between sound art, new media art, and contemporary critical theory, and transmission art, and I think that's actually, you know, we even see that in this institution, NASA, right, which has a history, a strong history of sound art, and so obviously that's leveraged in transmission art. So, as somebody who does cultural theory, for lack of a better word, I'm in the business of crafting arguments, right? And that's rather than talking about... I am going to talk about a couple pieces, maybe just one, because I have a tendency to digress, so one or two pieces. But really, I'm in the business of crafting arguments, and that's the way I want to talk about my work. When I say I'm in the business of crafting arguments, what I mean is I'm in the business... It's not a, really, I guess if it's a business, it has to make money. I'm in the habit of crafting arguments, the habit of building fictions about what it is that I'm doing, right, that can help us, or help me at least, to live in the world a little differently. So some of what I'm going to say is going to enter some conversations that you'd encounter, you know, at conferences or through certain literature in the area, but I'm really entering it not in the spirit of proving somebody right or wrong so much as just trying to pressure some of these things to say, well, how can this help me and by extension, possibly you, think differently about our practices. So the argument that I want to enter into, or the conversation I want to enter into, is specifically one that is somewhat well-known, published in a book by Seth Kim Cohen, a sound artist, sound theorist. And the book is called Towards a Non-Cochlear Sound Art. And basically in that book, Kim Cohen's arguing for a discursive turn in sound art, right? A movement away from thinking about sound as this kind of way of just encountering the world, of uncovering the truth of the world, right? And instead thinking about sound art in connection to visual art practices. I'll talk about that a bit more. But what I want to do with that argument is just push it a little bit towards something that I'm calling, as of this week, calling the sonic effect. So for me, what I mean by this term sonic effect, instead of sound, right? So sound implies there's something concrete there. What I mean by sonic effect is what Brian and LaBelle, who I know many of you know, or some of you, what he calls micro-epistemologies, right? Which is just this way of recognizing that things like echoes, vibrations, rhythms, for instance, if we think through those metaphors, right, they open up specific ways of knowing the world. That's sort of what I'm trying to do, is take these two very divergent arguments and see if there's a way to kind of mash them up a little bit in the spirit of audio art. So you can see already, I think, that there's a connection here, obvious connection to the concerns of transmission art, which pushes, I think, I would argue, many of these oral metaphors, things like waves, right, which have a history in sound art, pushes those metaphors in new directions. We understand waves very differently when we start to think about transmission than we do in the history of sound and music. So I'm going to make that argument, and then I'm going to talk about a creative work that I think specifically enacts that, if you will, Exurbia. And what this piece Exurbia does is it experiments with oral, what I'm calling oral avatars. It's a bit of a stretch to call them that, in a non-visual online community. Right? So it's kind of non-visual, non-textual as well, telepresence community, to use a term, telepresence, that doesn't get used much anymore. And then if there's time, as a kind of bonus track to the talk, I'll also talk about SRMP, but I can already see that that's unlikely to happen. Certainly, I'm happy to answer any questions. When we're done, maybe you can share any thoughts you have, or we can discuss further. I can answer questions. So, part one, medial specificity and this sonic effect. The problem of medial specificity, for those of you connected to the visual arts, is actually quite familiar. And what's interesting is, to a large extent, as a question, I mean, it still is active as a practice, but as a question, there's a certain sense in which it's long resolved, right? And specifically, the way that it's resolved is through a notion of expansion, the term expansion. This we find in Gene Youngblood, 1970s, talking about expanded cinema. Rosalind Krauss, really famously in 79, talks about expanded sculpture. And basically what expansion is, it connects to, at the time, contemporary philosophical movements. Somebody like Jacques Derrida, you might have heard his grammatology. But basically it's just a way of recognizing the porousness of an artwork's boundaries. Right? So the implicit verb in any frame. Right? Mika Bal, the visual theorist, talks about every frame is actually a framing. Right? It's not just a frame to a work, it's an act of framing. It happens in time, in a certain sense. And then also, you know, expansion is just a way, then, generally, of recognizing the way that artworks, culture, discourse are all tangled up in one another. So, if you know Clement Greenberg, right, expansion is kind of explicitly in opposition to some of his writing, sometimes correctly, sometimes falsely. But it's basically just saying, Greenberg, to the contrary, the work of art, when we talk about it doing something, we can't reduce that to just the boundaries of the work itself, right? And those boundaries aren't uncontested or fixed. So if you think about a picture in a gallery, right, we can say, oh yeah, that's the work, right? You put it on a wall, but by putting it on a wall, the wall becomes part of the work, the gallery becomes part of the work, the mechanism of entering and leaving, the institutional support, all those are, in a sense, part of the work of art. Which sounds glib or stupid in some ways, but really, if you've ever worked in an artist-run center, you understand these things come about in really material and specific ways. Right? Even just think about the difference between, I was involved with a really great artist-run center, and none of the visual artists would even consider the idea of having to pay to enter the space. Right? And yet, you had to pay to enter the space to go to a concert. Right? So it's these silly things, so all of a sudden our community would be split between the visual artists who would come to all the free openings but not pay $10 to sit still and listen to, you know, a show for an hour, right? So the way that it's framed, the mechanism of ticketing, of paying, of coming, all those things are part of what it is, part of what the artwork is. Part of being a visual artist in that context, that specific context, is not paying to see work, but the work is kind of a discussing point. So this conversation is actually pretty much old hat in the various discourses that we'll just call the visual arts, even though visual artists don't often like that term. But it's remained only peripheral. It's not excluded, but only peripheral to the discourses of music, and I would argue also to sound art, though the latter is in a little bit less obvious way. So with respect to music, just as a quick digression, and specifically I'm talking about what it's, you know, music has these awesome terms. They're just hilarious. Like, Western art music is an actual term. And to describe this notated music that is performed by orchestras, ensembles, that sort of thing. So in that respect, it's maybe not surprising that this is there's a kind of foundational conservatism to that discourse, right, that comes from it having a history in sacred practices, specific sacred practices, a history in colonial practices as well. So it's not necessarily that shocking that it's difficult for that to move, for those institutions to be kind of flexible in the way that the visual arts institutions are. But also with music, and this is what's going to sort of get us to sound art, and I think more importantly, there's what is discussed as a medial purity really at the heart of music. It's endowed with as music. And the most famous sort of statement that summarizes this is the 19th century critic and essayist Walter Pater. And he makes this famous or infamous claim that gets repeated, you know, ad infinitum, that all art constantly aspires to the condition of music, he says, right? And the reason he says that, or what that claim does, is it perfectly encapsulates the fiction of music, right? And we live by fictions all the time in every way, so it's not to say whether it's good or bad, but the fiction of music, right, as a kind of pure abstraction, right, something that doesn't relate to anything in the world, it relates to nothing but itself. So Pater's claim, right, that all art constantly aspires to the condition of music, it puts music as the kind of purest of the arts, precisely because its artness, what makes it art, only refers to itself, right? You don't listen to a piece of Bach and say, oh yeah, that's a piece by Bach, and say, oh yeah, that's about the problem of the terrible, terrible oppression of First Nations people in Canada. Right? It's just, it's very, very difficult to do that at the level of the music. So another way of saying this, since it's always nice to have multiple ways, is to say that music is positioned as being asemiotic, right? Which is to say that it is positioned as not reflecting anything except for music, right? And that's that is the heart of music. So, and you can see this, Seth Kim Cohen in the book that I'm going to discuss points this out really brilliantly. He says, you know, only music has a term like extra musical. A term that actually is there, so that describes things like staging, political references, performance practices, marketing, all that as though they're not part of the piece of music. Right? The term simply doesn't exist in the visual arts, the gallery arts. The extra artistic part or the extra visual part. Right? So music has at its core this fiction that the music itself is pure abstraction. So the point I'm getting to is that this means that you can't necessarily address the problem of music and discourse, this problem of how music connects to the world, just by expanding the semantic field of music, right? Because the semantic field, these discursive elements in the world, aren't part of music, right? It's like a sort of two ships passing in the night situation. And the decisive example here, and the most famous one, and the one that's going to get us closer to sound art, is the work of John Cage, right? Which would seem to, on its surface, deploy exactly this kind of expanded field, right? I'm sure everybody knows Cage's work, but he extensively uses chance operations, aleatorcism, right? And he technologizes silence. He says, he treats silence as though it's something tangible and positive. And these are both in service, as well as other techniques, of an understanding that would move music off of the page, right, and beyond the purview of a kind of intentional composerly rhetoric, right? So Cage's intervention expands this musical palette to include sounds in themselves and silence, independent of their notation and organization, which is great. And indeed, the ultimate sound in itself for Cage is silence, right? And I'm sure everybody knows this kind of apocryphal story of his experience in an anechoic chamber, but in case you don't, right, he's sitting in this chamber that seals him off from the world, and he hears these two sounds, which he attributes to being the sound of his blood circulating and his nervous system. In fact, the technicians at the time have said, you know, it's quite possible he just has early onset tinnitus, and that's one of the pitches that he's hearing. But it doesn't even matter, right? So he hears these two sounds in a situation that is supposed to seal him off from all sound. And so for Cage, this is like this amazing revelation. And it really is, right? And the revelation is that there's no such thing as silence, right? Which in turn means that sound isn't just this addition to reality. Sound is an ever-present stratum of reality. Right? So if we want to talk about the world, you want to talk about this coffee cup, you have to talk about it relative to sound as well as relative to its paper, right? It's kind of a profound, you know, it's one of those things that you're like, yeah, of course. And then, you know, generations of artists continue to make work based on that, you know, being what that catalyzes. So, Cage's gestures of expansion really broaden the rhetorical palette available to musicians, and I think also constitute an important politics within music. But they don't impact the purview of the rhetoric of music. They don't impact what... they change how music can speak, but we can't just assume that that changes what music can say. So there's this kind of expansion towards inclusivity of practices, I would argue, is actually accomplished via a kind of colonizing process that doesn't address, I mean, it does lots of wonderful things, right? But it doesn't address this fiction of music as being purely abstract. It doesn't address what I would call the discursive insularity that prevents music from talking about its connections to the world, right? Its concrete existence in the world. And this is the case because, you know, there's a really problematic assumption that lies at the heart of Cage's project. And again, there's a problem at the heart of everybody's project, right? So it's, I mean, all you can do is love John Cage, right? So please don't misunderstand that. But there's a problematic assumption that's at the heart of that project, namely that sound, again, somehow just signifies itself, right? That when we hear sound, it's a sound. And language, discourse, experience, the body, the world has nothing to do with it, right? So my friend Eldridge Priest argues that Cage's effort to open musical experience to a wider materiality through these kind of gestures, right, can only be made effective through a kind of rhetorical mover that basically ciphers off anything in the sound that isn't the sound, right? So any sound is musical so long as it's intentionally heard as music and unheard as being in the world. The maybe more famous, that's from Eldridge's forthcoming book on Continuum, really, really fantastic book. It's coming in a year or so. The more famous source for that similar argument, though, is Douglas Kahn in the book Noise, Water, Meat, right? And he says, under the guise of an opening up of sounds to the world, Cage builds a kind of musical bulwark against auditive culture, right? One founded on a musical identification with nature itself. So Kahn argues convincingly that basically this is accomplished through these very techniques of expansion that would seem to put Cage in this visual arts discourse, right? So by extending the process of music making or music incorporation to include all audibility, potentially audible and mythically audible sounds, there's no longer there are no more sounds to incorporate into music, right? So music then becomes a kind of pure listening, a pure concentration. And of course, the reference here is to Cage's 433, the silent piece, right? So where's this sort of taking us? The medial specificity of sound in music means that any additional elements that are brought into music become colonized by music. They become music, right? They're not political. They're not in the world. They are music. And what is music? Music is this pure, abstract thing. So music can never be medially specific in a certain sense because its specificity exists only prior to any particular instantiation of it, right? Whatever happens, it's going to be music, right? And indeed, you know, we see this in performances all the time. Artists leverage this all the time, right? You're in this setup. If I were here as a musician, not as a talking head, whatever I hear, you'd be prepared to hear as music, I think. Hopefully, you'd be so generous. If anybody is in contemporary media studies, we would say that music presents itself as an origin, as a kind of creation myth of sound, rather than as a history of sound. And if you want to understand why that's important, just think about the difference between creation myths and history that are played out, for example, in the U.S. around the Christian right and evolution. That's the difference between a creation myth and a history. One is in the world, caught up in thinking about our values as being historically constituted, always changing, and we are changing. And one says, this is right, this is wrong. So, to speak about musical specificity in music is as fraught as speaking about truth in painting, sculpture, and all of these things that are kind of discussed in the visual arts and in a certain sense dismissed with the decline of modernism, right? When painting sort of leaves this gesture towards being pure painting and starts to engage its being in the world. But there's a really important distinction between how that's happened in the discourse of music from the discourse of visual arts. So in the case of visual arts, there are all these conceptual terms, right? I don't mean the capital C conceptual term. I mean all these different ways of thinking about how we think is part of these works, right? And they happen one after another. You think Duchamp, Picasso, pick a name post, well, somebody pick a name and pick a date, and after that date, it's filled with these conceptual terms, right? 20th century visual art is, in a certain sense, defined in that way. And these explicitly engage this kind of paradox that we can focus on a work, and by focusing on the work, we can focus on the things that aren't in the work, if that makes sense, right? It's like a kind of resonant object for the world. In a certain sense, that's what art does. There are all these things that connect to the work. By focusing on the work, you pretend that the work is cut off from the world so that you can have fresh insight into the world or something like that. I don't know. But music deals with its excesses, deals with its way of connecting to the world in a really dramatically different way, and that way is called sound art. Right? Kim Cohen says in his book, he says, sound art is positioned, and I think he's right, as a discrete practice, separate from music. I think this group would testify to that, right? It's a discrete practice, and it's the remainder created by music closing off its borders to the extra musical, right? So this isn't the result, and this is really important, it's not the result of specific decisions by specific people, right, within sound art and music. It's not like somebody says, I'm going to be a sound artist or I'm going to be a musician. It's a result of them being very different histories, right? And as far as music goes, there is no other option available except to treat sound art as a separate set of practices altogether. Again, just think of the biographies of the individual practitioners, right? And there's actually relatively little overlap. So sound art becomes, in this story that we're telling, becomes a way of solving music's problem of closing off its connections to the world. Music becomes, in sound art, a historical practice, which is a good thing, right? It becomes a historical practice concerned, if we want to talk about music, right, its history is concerned with itself as music. You want to talk about sound art, all of a sudden it's situated in the world. It's a historical practice that is situated relative to the various political histories of the world. Wonderful, right? So, but the problem isn't quite that easily solved. It would be nice if it were, right? And here again, we'll return just briefly to Douglas Kahn talking about Cage. And he noticed that in this myth of listening, and I apologize if you've read the book, but it's really, really an incredible insight, right? In this myth of listening, where Cage hears two sounds, whatever they are, right? And understanding that this is the moment, this is the origin, this is the inception of sound art in a certain way, right? In this myth of listening, when he hears two sounds, he's hearing a third, right? And that what is, I mean, you could probably predict what that third sound is, and namely, it is the sound of his little voice in his head saying, hey, whoa, I'm hearing two sounds even though I'm in an anechoic chamber, right? And this, calling this a sound, right, is, of course, totally antithetical to Cagean listening, right? Because it means that there's something in competition with the sounds themselves in the world.
Like a vision, she dances across the porch as the radio plays. Roy Orbison singing for the lonely. Radio's on and I'm moving round the place. I got the radio on and I'm just killing time. Will I turn? Cherry says she's gonna walk, cause she found I took the radio in hot day. I get a call on the short way.
There'll be a radio playing, and you'll hear me sing this song. When I lay down at night, I don't get no sleep, so I turn on the radio. The night speaks in search, lights and short with radio's phone.
The radio relay tires on to lead me to my baby.
The preceding show was produced by Free 103.9 at the WGXE Studios in New York.